Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Now we're going to have some live music. With me in our Studio 7 are the Lost Brothers. They've been together since 2006 and their latest album, After the Fire, After the Rain, has been getting rave reviews since it was released last week, February the 7th. They're about to start both an Irish and American tour. Good morning, Oisín Leach and Mark McCausland. Thanks so much for coming in. Listen, this is your sixth album. I think one that's most rooted in Ireland. All of the songs written here referencing places near you both. Gertrude Glen, near where you live, Mark and Oma, and also the Boyne and Tara Navan, where you're from, Oisín.
Yeah, we've gone back to the source a bit with this album. And for some reason, we found ourselves writing more about home and less about being away.
Yeah, that's understandable. And also, you, Oisín, in particular, tell me about one of the songs, I think, called After the Fire. And just before you were going down to record it, you heard about the Plaza Ballroom in Buncrana had burned down. And I think that is a real family connection for you.
Yeah, my grandmother and grandfather in Buncrana actually grew up there. My granny actually collected the glasses, booked the bands and even played piano there. Each night in the morning, Mark and I began to record in Brooklyn exactly a year ago, actually this week. We got a text to say that, you know, tragically, the night before, it had been an electrical fault and a fire. So it was poignant because the first song we did that morning was After the Fire. So it was tragic, but they're rebuilding it now.
Great.
We spent a lot of our childhood there. And actually, Mark's grandfather had a band, the Moore family, and they passed through there.
Oh.
We've told that story a few times.
Yeah.
But in the 60s, Mark's grandfather would have passed through there. So it's a beautiful venue, right, on the main street in Buncrana.
And it's lovely they're rebuilding. And Mark, of course, you're from Oma. You live in Oma. Your new album, I think, recorded in New York, but was one of your producers Bob Dylan's longtime bass player, Tony Garnier?
Yeah, Tony, yeah. We met him over in Germany, actually, a couple of years ago and just stayed friends. And then when we were writing this new album, he was kind of on the other end of the phone saying, well, I've got a week off next week and I'm around New York if yous are in New York. And we got on the internet right away and just looked at flights and we were like, yeah.
We're in New York.
Yeah, we're in New York.
on the way.
That's so good. Now, listen, of course, you have a big tour next month. I think it's beginning on the 20th of March in Oma, your home place, Mark Vicar Street, the 21st.
Yeah, we're Oma, Miriam, and then we're Belfast, Dublin, Galway, Castlebar, Letterkenny, Waterford, Cork and Limerick.
Fantastic. Yeah. You're going to sing two songs for us today now and then at the end of the show. The first one is Fugitive Moon.
Yep.
Take it away.
Thanks.
I can feel the raging of hell. Will I make it this time? I just can't tell. Over my shoulder, I know it's coming soon. I laid it all on the line for a fugitive moon. I've been cursed since the day I was born with a racing mind. It's been battered and torn, squandered my youth. I was bound to lose. When I place my life in the hands of a fugitive moon, standing where the Boyne flows, who knows where the time goes. The fugitive moon makes a shadow of you. always running from view. Damn the fugitive moon, the fugitive moon. Here I am waiting, my path you can trace. It's been both a poison and a saving grace. My heart is vacant like a desolate room. Now all I've got left is a fugitive moon. Standing where the Bourne flows, who knows where the time goes, when the fugitive moon makes a shadow of you. Always running from view, turns me into a fool, the fugitive moon, the fugitive moon, the fugitive moon, the fugitive moon.
That was beautiful. Actually, someone just tweeted Jimmy Stafford saying those Lost Brothers are just sublime on Miriam playing now. And it is sublime, actually. And another fan says, Christine in Armagh, I'm a big fan. Where can I find the details of their Irish tour?
Yeah, so it's all on the lostbrothersband.com, Miriam. All the Irish tour dates are up there. Yeah, and there's an order thing for the album.
Well, look, you're coming back.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. Now, Peter O'Brien may be what is known as a couturier, a fashion designer for some of the finest fashion houses in Paris, including Chloé Rochas, that's how you pronounce it, I've just checked with him, and Christian Dior. But when Peter eventually returned to Dublin, he began designing for theatre, but also working with some of our biggest high street names, including Awear, Arnott's and Dunn's, where he still is working, designing clothes for women with a little less cash, but no less style. And next month, Peter is giving a talk as part of the Virgin Media Dublin International Film Festival to talk about how films and old Hollywood directly influenced his career and his designs. Peter O'Brien, good morning.
Good morning, Mary.
How are you? Tell us first of all, you grew up in Finglas.
I did. Well, yeah. I was born in the UK, in London. My parents had run off to get married, and then we came home when I was probably 6 or 7. And yeah, we lived in Dunleary for a while because Dad's family were from Dunleary. Mm. And then I grew up mostly in Finglas, yeah.
And where did your love of fashion come from?
Well, I don't know. I think... It's really strange. I just was fascinated by clothes. I'll give you an example of what an odd child I was. When when we were in O'Connell's, we used to do a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta every year. And we were doing HMS Pinafore, and I was one of the sisters, cousins and aunts. Because before your voice had broken, you played, you know, the girls' parts. Yeah. And we got our costumes from either Burke's or Ging's, I can't remember which, in the days when Dublin had, you know, theatrical costume houses. And mine was a kind of generic Victorian floral printed dress, which we were given to take home for our mothers to hem. And I went to Wine Ribs on the Keys and bought sequins, this is absolutely true, and re-embroidered on all of the roses, little sequins. So, of course, all the sisters and cousins tripped out on stage of the O'Connell's Hall and me glittering like Shirley Bassey, the only one. So I guess it was kind of in my blood forever. You know, yeah, I loved twinkly things and I was just really interested in clothes. I was fascinated by them. And Mum said, and my teachers always, I used to get into trouble. I was always drawing ladies on my copybooks, always in big dresses.
And of course, you loved your mom, Muriel, and I know she was a big influence. And she, did she only just die in December?
Yeah, Mum passed away in December. Yes, she did, yeah.
And were you interested in her clothes? And was she interested in her
clothes? Yeah,
she
loved clothes. My mum was great looking, and Mum had 4 sisters. And my dad had 4 sisters. So they were all my glamorous aunties, you know. Yeah. And I remember being a little boy, and back in the day, there used to be dress dances. And Auntie Sissy was the secretary for the Dublin Musical Society. And I know she used to have a big posh dress every year for their big ball. And my Auntie Evelyn and Auntie Enid and Dunleary were very glamorous. And I remember them in their big kind of dance dresses. And I thought it was all very magical and glamorous. I was a strange little boy, but very self-contained and quite happy. You know, I just... Yeah. But old movies were... I remember we didn't have a TV because my father, when he was still around, he kind of disapproved of it. And Michael Donoghue, who lived next door to me, had a TV. And on Sunday afternoons, they used to be all black and white movies. And I remember seeing Humoresque with Joan Crawford, who plays this kind of glamorous society woman who's in love with a classical musician. And she believes she's bad for his career. And she walks into the sea in the end. But she's wearing this fabulous black Adrian Bugle beaded dress. And I was devastated by this dress being destroyed. I was 12 and I cared about this dress much more than poor Joan, who was dying. You know, I was distressed about the ruination of this
dress.
Yeah.
And I know you mentioned your dad disappeared there. We're not going to talk about that because I mentioned that to you earlier, because there's lots of relations still alive.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
We're sensitive about that. Now, apparently you left school after your intercert because the family didn't have enough money. Did you work in Arnott's and Best's in their window display?
Yeah, I did. I worked in Best's, then I worked in Arnott's. And I went off to London when I was about 19, 20. Mm-hmm. And I worked in Marshall and Snellgrove's in Oxford Street, in display again. And then I applied. I met Eve Pollard, who was Claudia Winkleman's mother. She had written an article about fashion and I sent her in some of my drawings. And she advised me to go to St. Martin's. So I did. I got together a lot of drawings and I went. And I got a grant and I did a degree there. And then I did a postgraduate in Parsons in New York. But it was really at St. Martin's that I discovered my absolute love of movies. You know, there was a film society and I lived on Holland Road in Russell Gardens, and there was the old Gate Cinema in Notting Hill Gate. Mm. And they would have seasons of Fred and Ginger movies or Garbo movies. So I was absolutely. And plus, when I was in London in the early 70s, there was a huge kind of retro wave that for the 30s and 20s and 30s, Beebus had just opened and Walter Albini was designing very kind of 30s clothes and Lagerfeld in Paris. So there was this whole kind of wave of love of 1930s Art Deco, all of that. So I was kind of swept up in that. I don't like Deco so much anymore, but what did I know back then? But I loved all those old black and white films and all those amazing costumes.
And how then did you get Peter to work for those big design houses I mentioned earlier?
In Paris?
Yeah.
Well,
and was that great fun?
It was fantastic. I went with my friend Debbie Little. We went off to Paris and we stayed in the Hotel Mary in the Rue Saint-Anne. And the reason we stayed there was because it was opposite the club Set, which was the coolest club to go to. So we used to, and the Hotel Mary was basically a knocking shop and we used to stay there. It really was. I mean, okay. There was hookers left, right and centre. It was great. But we would call up the press offices and ask if they'd any jobs. And there was always someone in the press office who spoke English. And if they didn't, we had kind of prompter boards, you know, Je suis un styliste irlandais. And I got a job at Dior as a junior assistant. And then I went from Dior. I worked at Givenchy. And then I met Gabby Aguillon, the woman who ran Chloe. And I went to work at Chloe as Guy Pollan's assistant. And then Guy left and I took over. I really wasn't experienced enough to do this. I mean, I know this now, you know. I designed Chloe. And then I went off to America I fell in love and ran after someone to live in America. Really bad reason to go to America. And then...
Did it last?
Of course it didn't.
Okay.
Kind of like a transplanted flower. You know, you put it in a different pot and it dies. and then Rochas contacted me and I went back and I worked at Rochas from 89 till 2004.
Wow. So that's really high-end fashion.
Yeah, it was. It was high-end fashion.
This is a terrible thing to say to a fashion designer. I often think it's an awful... No, people are going to scream. An awful waste of money sometimes to spend a fantastic amount. I know you're probably going to kill me.
No, I'm not.
Just, you know, for me, I can't understand why people spend so much money on clothes.
There's a kind of puritanism about clothes. I think people will accept if you spend a lot of money on a car, on a house...
But a house you live in, a car you need to drive.
The thing about clothes is very expensive clothes. I was talking to the women outside who you've got on after me.
The politicians.
The politicians. Yeah. Fashion has changed radically in that the very, very, very expensive clothes you see on London Fashion Week, particularly Paris Fashion Week, Milan, those big houses are owned by mostly two big multinational corporations. The clothes serve a different purpose to what they used to be. Mm. It used to be once upon a time rich women bought posh dresses. This isn't what happens anymore. Some rich women do, but mostly the clothes are marketing tools to sell handbags, to sell perfume.
Okay.
Because they're very expensive to produce. You know, silk now can cost from somewhere like Clerici or Canepa, the big Italian fabric companies, can cost 200, 300, 400 euro a metre.
Yeah,
and, you know, people happily nowadays, those wonderful technicians who make the clothes, they're my favourite people in the whole world. I love the ladies in their white jackets in Paris. They're wonderful. Yeah. They're kind of miracle workers. You know, I do the easy bit, they do the really. Mm. But they now make a decent living, happily.
Oh, good.
So
okay.
They really do. If you're a premier in an atelier in Paris, you know, they could buy a house in D4. I mean, they really make good money. So the clothes now have become so expensive. And the whole thing with influencers and actors now get paid, you know, to wear them, you know, or they have contracts. So the whole thing has changed. It used to be, as I say, about people actually buying the dresses, and that's what ticked the business over. You know, when Dior was functioning, 49, 50, 51, they had something like 2,000 employees in the House of Dior. Ateliers full of people sewing for those rich women who had the time and the leisure to go and have three fittings for a dress. No one can do that anymore, you know. So it's all changed.
Yeah. I suppose it is someone's choice if they have a lot of money, if they want. It's just...
Yeah, there is something gorgeous about really beautiful clothes. There's something... I kind of love fabric and I get very excited by it. There's something wonderful about it.
You said as well, I think, once, which I like, you said women shouldn't really have a uniform. What did you mean by that? In other words...
Well, Mrs. Vreeland said that. Yeah. She said everyone over 40 should have a uniform, which is not only sexist and ageist. I like uniforms.
You don't actually mean uniforms. I mean, like, you just dress the same.
Dressing the same. I think most people do. Yeah, I think people
agree.
Find their kind of thing that they like and they just wear it, you know. I don't kind of care about clothes for me. I like to be invisible myself.
You look smart now. I like your brooch.
That's my weakness. I like these Victorian pins.
Yeah, it's lovely.
I found a website online that sells diamond brooches. So, I mean, in case anyone's thinking of breaking into my house, they have no resale value and the stones are tiny and they're not worth anything. Anyway.
Do you think fashion matters?
Yes, I think fashion absolutely matters. I think it matters because even people who say they don't care about clothes, they make a choice about what they pick up and what they put on their back. I think fashion says everything. I think if you want to know a period, really know a period, look at the clothes. It tells you so much about politics, about how, you know, social life. I think it's close. Tell a million stories.
Do you have any pet hates? Like, you actually, interesting, before we came on air, you said you're not going to be critical. And actually, you were interesting in saying a lot of the time, women can be often critical of other women.
Online, certainly, yes.
Do you have any pet hates?
I don't like to do this because it's really, really unfair. And you know, I'm a late middle-aged, looking towards ancient, balding, overweight man. So what right do I have to say to anyone what they should or shouldn't wear? I'm not crazy about... I kind of like mystery. And I think we live in an age where the aesthetics of pornography have become the aesthetics of every day. And if you look at something like something as benign as Strictly, as less benign than Love Island, it has become normal. For to have no body hair, to have no body fat, but to have bags of silicone in your chest. The boys have no body hair. There's this odd kind of over, you know, women, young women particularly, are given this message. And I think the two things are very strange. We live in this Me Too time where sexual politics have changed so radically. And yet the only message young women get in the media is, I am only valid if I'm hot. I think this is extraordinary. And how the two, I mean, someone much smarter than me will write a great thesis on this one day. But I think it's really interesting that we've normalized being hot as being the most important thing a woman can be. I mean, I might be wrong on this, but I feel quite strongly about it.
Interesting. Now, our listener says, Ken McHugh texted to say he was a helper with you, Peter, in Arnott's Windows. Ken, yes. He remembers him drawing outfits for women on the back of sales tickets.
Yeah, I used to. I drew on everything, yeah.
Also, another says, a delight to hear Peter interviewed. I bought a coat from his first collection for A-Wear many years ago and I wear it still. It's always admired.
I love to hear that.
And one more. Ask Peter if he enjoyed his time working in Foley Street, a lot different to Paris. That's from Brian McKenna.
I remember Foley Street because when I worked at Best, we had a storeroom down in Foley Street. Absolutely. Yeah, I do remember.
I love live radio. Yeah. Now, listen, you are giving this talk on your cinematic inspirations.
Yes.
It's part of the Virgin Media Dublin International Film Festival on the 8th of March at the Chocolate Factory. Tickets are free.
Yes.
But anyone who wants to go just has to register for them on the website diff.ie. That's diff.ie.
We'll have lots of film clips of gorgeous frocks and all kinds of nice things.
Peter O'Brien, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you,
Miriam. As ever. We'll chat again. Let's
take
a break. Well, last weekend was one of political turmoil as voters opted for change, voting in many new politicians. But what of those who weren't celebrating last Sunday and Monday and who are facing into a new life without handlers, media advisors, portfolios and power? And in particular, at a time when our society is anxious to increase female participation in politics, what about the women who lost their seats? Constituencies did not elect a single woman, and only 36 female politicians will enter the new Dáil out of 160. Well, I've gathered this morning some of those women with me. In our studio, I have Labour's Jan O'Sullivan, a former minister, independent and still Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, Catherine Zappone, Fine Gael's Regina Doherty, who also remains as Minister for Employment Affairs and Social Protection, and joining us on the line from Mayo is Fianna Fáil's Lisa Chambers. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Miriam.
Okay, listen, I'll start with you, Catherine Zappone.
Okay.
What was it like losing your seat? Was it difficult?
Oh, yes, it was difficult. Yes, it was. And, of course, I felt great disappointment. But, you know, Miriam, I felt at least equal, if not more, disappointment for my extraordinary team that worked so hard with me, as well as the various people that are on my political team that will lose their jobs as a result of that. And, you know, but at the same time, I had the extraordinary opportunity to represent the people of Dublin Southwest. I was very appreciative that they voted me in the first time, for the people who voted me the second time. But there's no question about it. It's tough.
Regina?
Yeah, I think Catherine's right. So, like, I kind of felt a bit numb is probably the nicest way. And I expected to feel, I genuinely expected to feel sad or to have a whinge or whatever. And that didn't come. And everybody in my family is waiting for me every day this week to have a meltdown. And again, it hasn't come because I actually feel I've had a wonderful 10 years. It's nearly 11 years since I was first elected to the council. I've had it's like being a whirlwind. I had a wonderful 5 years as a backbench in Fine Gael for the first 5 years. Then I was chief whip. Then I was minister. Like it nearly kind of feels surreal that I've done all that in such a short space of time. And I'm so grateful for the experience. But I'm also equally excited for what's next. And I haven't a clue what that is yet, but I am equally excited. But I think Catherine's right. The saddest part for me is the wonderful people that I've worked with and for over the last number of years, because they also lose their jobs. And so they mightn't be feeling as excited as what's next excuse me, as bad I am. And I've had wonderful fellas and men working with me, the guys in the office, the people in the department. Like, I know sometimes you hear people giving out about civil servants, but I've had the privilege of working with some of the most dedicated, down-to-earth, decent, hard-working people over the last number of years. And it has been the privilege of my career to date. And so, whilst I can't tell you I've enjoyed every minute of the last 10 years, some of them have been a bit ropey. In the main, it's been a wonderful experience and something that I'll always treasure, you know. So,
Jan?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose elections are such a roller coaster. You know, I described it as being like walking the Camino. You know, you get up every morning, you walk all day, you fall into bed, you get up and do the same thing for 3 weeks the next day. But you're very much part of a team. And I think for me, it was a kind of a communal experience, I suppose, of feeling, oh my God, we've lost the seat, you know. And like the other two, the people who work in my constituency office were my first thought, and keeping the office open, keeping the team going, keeping, you know, the presence in the constituency. We've got three really good young councillors from my own party on the council in Limerick. And so I suppose my thoughts were not so much for myself, because I've had actually 21 years in the Dáil in opposition and in government. I've had, you know, an extraordinary experience as a public representative. But I did feel it very much for the team. I'm beginning to realise now that there's actually personal time that I never had for a long, long time now. And I'm looking forward to that. But I'm still in the situation of trying to make sure that what I was working in for the last 21 years will continue, but obviously with other people leading it.
Lisa, how was it for you?
Yeah, it's actually nice to hear the other ladies speak about the experience. It was a kind of a surreal, I mean, it was 2:30 in the morning, Sunday night, I suppose Monday morning, when the result came in Mayo. So it had been a really long day, and we thought that we were going to have to come back on Monday, but then the count continued on. So everybody was quite tired. We had all gone home and then was back into the count centre to get the results. And I mean, it's difficult, but I think when it happens at that point in time, I knew I had to get up on the stage in the town centre and give a speech. So that was my first thought, is just to kind of, right, you've got a job to do, you've got to get this done. My two staff were there with me, and I just thought, you do think, oh God, they've lost their jobs and it's my fault. But that is your first thought. And on the same count, Michelle Mulhern was unsuccessful as well. So I felt for her, and, you know, I gave her a hug. And, you know, so there's winners and losers in every election, but it's a difficult moment, and you're surrounded by your family and your team, and they're all looking at you, and they're devastated for you, but equally you're devastated for them, because they've put as much into it as you have. You know, as Jan said, they've got up every morning and they've walked the roads with you, or driven the bullhorns, as it is in many rural constituencies, and you feel almost like you've let everybody else down. If it was just yourself affected, it'd be much easier to deal with.
And actually, your line isn't great, but we're going to keep it, Lisa, because you're in Mayo, and I want to keep you on the line. But Lisa, when you got up that morning, I was just interested, even doing the coverage, were you nervous? I mean, did you think you might lose your seat? And did you almost talk to yourself so you can just be able to cope with it when it does happen?
Yeah, no, I knew that there was a possibility of losing it, because getting the seat in 2016, I always refer to it as the miracle seat of the election for us, because we did it on really small percentages. So in 2016, Fine Gael had 51% of the vote, and we had just over 28. So, and we took 2 and 2. So it was really, the transfers just fell right on the day to take that second seat. So I knew in this election that if there was a squeeze from Sinn Féin, in the Fianna Fáil vote in Mayo, we had nothing to give. If we dropped at all, I knew I was in trouble. Whereas Fine Gael could afford to drop even up to 20% and still hold 2 seats. So I knew if there was a squeeze, if there was going to be a change, I knew that I was the most vulnerable, because I took the last seat on the last election. So mentally, you are preparing yourself just for the possibility of it. But, you know, when it happens, it's different. And, you know, it's difficult. Nobody likes to lose. It's very public as well, obviously. You know, you just put yourself before the people, and it's a very public thing. And that's difficult to deal with. And it's, you know, you just kind of have to make your peace with it. And, you know, I had a lot of colleagues across the country that were in the exact same boat as me, that lost their seats. So I wasn't alone. And, I mean, we were on the phone to one another, just, I suppose, support, which was nice as well. And then colleagues that were successful were ringing and seeing how, just checking in. So, you know, there's a huge sense of camaraderie as well. You lose people, and it's kind of, if you make it back yourself, you do think of the colleagues that didn't make it back. So,
and actually, Catherine, on that camaraderie, because even I watched the three of you here in Dublin earlier, yourself, Jan, Regina, different parties, but there does seem to be a cross-party camaraderie between a lot of the women politicians. Is that right?
Oh, yes, there is. And again, just in my experience, obviously, it was just this the 32nd all. and of course, there were more women elected for that one than ever before. And I just thought that was so significant. And I remember, too, you know, really making a decision to ensure that whatever party the women were, or other independents, that I would reach out and to try to, you know, develop really strong cooperative relationships. And I can remember the day too. I don't know, Lisa, you if you remember this, just walking across from where I was sitting over to you and just thanking you for your strong stance in relation to the repeal issue. And that really, if there was any way in which I could support you in that, I would be so happy to do. You know, for me, it was especially reaching out to the younger women who had been elected for the first time.
John?
Yeah, just on the mention of the Eighth Amendment, like Lisa and myself, Kate O'Connell, Ruth Coppinger, we would have all been on that committee and spent a lot of time down in that basement, you know, on a really important issue. And it was particularly, to me, it was particularly personal because my first election campaign was in 1983, trying to stop it going into the Constitution. And so in a way, it came full circle. But those four that I mentioned, we all lost our seats. You know, you just have to, I mean, being a public representative and particularly being, you know, a minister, which the two beside me are and which I was, but, you know, generally being involved in committees, being involved in trying to make progress, you spend a lot of time in Dublin, you spend a lot of time in the Parliament, and you don't have as much time as you would like to knock on doors. And, you know, I suppose one of my regrets is that there weren't more than 24 hours in the day, because then I would have done all those things. But you have to kind of find that balance. But yet, you know, the names I mentioned, like from different political backgrounds, all losing our seats. Yeah. I think, you know, there is something there about, you know, doing what you need to do as a legislator and what you're passionate about and why you're there in the first place. And at the same time, winning your seat is not always an easy balance to get right.
And also, Regina, obviously men also lost their seats. I'm conscious, but this morning we're focusing on women, sure, because we've tried for so long to get more women into politics. Now there's one more in this parliament. Why do you think it's so slow? Why, like, did you find, and I'll ask all of you this, I'll come to you, Lisa, in a moment, but is it more difficult, do you think, being a female politician than a male politician?
I actually don't know, because I've never been a male politician. So, I tell you what I do know. I think we get more grief. I think we get more stick. Mm. You definitely get more abuse. Now, the lads get loads of abuse too, but I think our abuse is very personal. I was talking to the ladies outside that if I had a euro for every time I've been called the C word in the last month, I wouldn't need to retire.
Which is, it just is shocking, actually.
Yeah, and like, actually, even what Jan has just pointed out, I've been witness to a number of emails, and I don't know whether you guys have got the same, from people who would have been pro-life gleefully telling me that that's the reason that I lost my seat. No, I don't. It's not. There's buckets of reasons why I lost my seat, and we won't pinpoint any one of them. But for somebody to be so base as to actually put pen to paper in an email and send you like their willful gleeness because of a particular issue, like, I don't know what the world is coming to be honest with you. And even last night, that gorgeous young lady dying. You know, so yeah. I think we all need to take a reality check as to how we actually deal with people. I know politicians don't have the best regard by Irish people, but we do work hard. And I think I agree with Jan, probably to the expense of going out and doing what would be vote getting, whether it's knocking on doors or doing popular things. I didn't get into politics to do popular things. I got into politics to do the stuff that I think mattered. I asked for the Department of Social Protection, and I certainly didn't do anything in it that would garner Fine Gael support or voters, but I think I did the right thing and I'll never regret that. But I do think we need to look at the way we speak to each other, the way we treat each other.
It's just Lisa, did you find that you got, you know, abuse as well online?
Oh God, yes. It was quite intensive, and I would agree. I mean, I think all politicians get abuse, but I do think there's a different level for female politicians. It's a lot more personalised. It's a lot more based on, you know, the tone of your voice, the colour of your hair, how you dress. I'm pregnant currently, so that was coming up a little bit as well. That, oh, she'd be taking maternity leave. No point in electing her. Mm-hmm. So there's an extra level, I think. You know, you just have to be so careful about how you come across, because being assertive, you know, for a woman is often being bossy or aggressive or whiny, or, you know, I think there's just a different standard, I think. And I think that maybe it sells more papers when you have, you know, a female politician that puts a foot wrong, and it maybe looks better on the pages. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you deal with that. And I think the only way to deal with that really is maybe to talk about it a bit more. More women in politics, more women elected, more of a critical mass. But, you know, just to say, Cathkin, I do remember that time you walked across the hall floor to me. And there really was a sense of camaraderie among all of us, and with Jan as well, and Kate and Regina, and all of the women that were quite involved in that campaign. You know, we kind of knew there was a smaller number of us, but that we had an important role to play, each of us within our own political groupings. And there was great support. You know, we got on very well. And I think we realised as well that there was a lot of work to be done, you know, in the coming decade as well, just to get more women into Dáil Éireann. It's an important thing that has to happen. And I just don't know why it's so slow. I really don't.
And I'm deliberately not going into any issues or, you know, it's not prime time this morning. I'm just interested in where Catherine Sapone. Are you opting out of politics, or are you going to go again?
I've had a wonderful time in Irish politics, and no, I won't be going again, Miriam. No,
definitely.
No. Yeah.
Does that make you sad or happy?
Well, of course, you know, there's a loss that we've all experienced, and of course that brings up a lot of sadness, as we've said, both for ourselves as well as others. So I feel, again, I have had 9 wonderful years in Irish politics. Every single moment, especially of being a minister, was a privilege as well as an opportunity. Every single moment. And I always felt that. I feel that that's completed now. And I'm ready to move on. I have other ambitions and hopes. So I'm happy to move on. Yeah.
And you, John?
Yeah, I've had 21 years. I was elected in by-election in 1998. I spent most of that in opposition, actually, only a small number of years in government. And I'm not running anymore either.
Definitely
not. No, my posters have gone to be to be recycled. So I'm not putting them up again. But look, as I said before, we've got 3 young councillors. It's time to move on. My own party is obviously still in a rebuilding situation, and I'll be very much part of that. I will be absolutely active, but not as a public representative.
Is that kind of relief mixed with disappointment? What for you?
It was disappointment in losing the seat, but as soon as I look to the future, there is a sense of relief. If I wasn't here this morning, Miriam, I'd be up on the side of a hill in Southeast Clare, which I've been doing every Sunday morning for a long time now, and I'll do a lot more of that now. With friends that have been my friends for decades. So, you know, I've always kept little bits of time for myself. But I am looking forward. But I'm also looking forward to still doing the political work, but in a different role.
Regina?
I think you're getting a hat trick here now this morning. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And not because of any regrets, because I have no regrets, but it has been a wonderful 10 years. And what I would hate to do is to spend the next couple of years chasing something that, you know, might have been. I have no regrets. I've genuine gratitude for the experience that I've had and for what I've actually achieved, and I'm proud of what I've achieved, right? And I'm only a young one in my head, so I think I have something else left to do, to give. I don't know what that is yet. I did Irish homework with my 13-year-old this week for the first time in probably about 2 years, and she was quite apt to point that out. But actually, one of the days she came home and I answered the door to her and I got the best hug, and that suddenly hit me. I haven't been there. And I, not that I didn't notice that I wasn't there, but you're so busy trying to do everything for everybody else. I have to learn how to say no which I haven't been able to do for the last number of years. And so I'm kind of excited as to what's next, but also to re-engage. I have four lovely kids, a great husband, I have a really good marriage. I have a mum and dad who live around the corner for me, a new little niece. You know, there's loads of stuff that I've been neglecting. Because you're so busy on this treadmill, you know, running forward all the time, I just want to have some time for me and to see what's next. So,
Lisa, what are your plans?
I don't know just yet. I feel like I'm only kind of getting started in politics. I'm definitely the baby of the discussion today. So, I mean, I spent 2 years in the local council and just 4 years in the Dáil. So it was a short enough stint in election politics. And I feel like I have more to do. I don't know what that is exactly. I'm certainly not going to close the door on it this week. So we'll see what comes.
When is your baby due, Lisa?
April.
Is it your first baby?
It is, yeah.
That's exciting. Yeah. Are you excited?
I'm really excited. Yeah. I think now I have a little bit of time to think about it and prepare, which is really nice. So now I'm very much looking forward to it. And it's definitely my family are really looking forward to it as well. It's the first grandchild on our side, so it'll be exciting.
Yeah. Catherine, for maybe younger women now who want to go into politics, what would you say to them? Would you advise them to go in? What are the pros and the cons?
May I say directly to Lisa that I really, really hope that you come back. Yeah. You really were such an articulate, passionate parliamentarian
and brave.
I just hope we see you back. And for, you know, absolutely, of course, I want to encourage other women. And in fact, you know, again, with the privilege of being especially the children's minister and minister for young people, I'd often go around, meet a lot of especially younger women, and I take them by the hand, I look them straight in the eye, and I say, you know, this is your time. This is your time. It's your time. It's your era. Yeah. And step up to the plate. And they were, they would often say, yes, okay. I think there's just so much more. Obviously, they have to be willing to do that. And they have to have people who will support them in doing that as well. John?
Yeah, absolutely. I would encourage women to get involved in politics. I mean, I was just thinking about some of the campaigns recently, the marriage equality referendum and the Eighth Amendment, where there was a huge raft of young people of both genders, but in the Eighth Amendment, I suppose, more female than male. And those young people were passionate about an issue. But I'd love to see more passion about actually getting into the, I suppose, more, in some ways, more difficult, because it's not just something that's, you do it and then it's done at the end of that campaign. But to get into mainstream politics and actually, you know, get in there and do the work that actually makes a difference and brings about change in society.
Yeah, I want to concur just with what Catherine said, particularly to you, Lisa. You have been a force, a dominating force in the last maybe 24 months. And we definitely do need more women in politics. And so please, I know things are difficult and decisions are made sometimes from a place of hurt or whatever, but you definitely have a bright future and this is only a blip. So keep going. But we do need to encourage women. And whether it's for 5 years or 25 years, they need to be able to come into the profession because it is an honourable profession. And I know, you know, you wouldn't get that if you did a poll in the morning, but everybody that I know in politics, and particularly the women, are hardworking, decent and thoughtful people. And they do what they do because they care, whether it's about their own community, about the society, about an issue, as Jan has said. And when we work together, we can move mountains.
But maybe, you know, as we said earlier, a lot of women don't go in. It's 22.5% now. Because there is so much abuse. I mean, even when I tweeted this morning, to be honest,
we were talking about that.
And I hope people are listening who have sent those nasty texts, actually, or messages that you were coming on. The bile. Yeah, I'm sorry. At the end of the day, this is the moment. You're politicians. Three of you are no longer running. We're having a nice chat. But the level of nastiness out there is extraordinary. Lisa, do you worry about that going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that we have to address, and I know that Caroline Flack was mentioned this morning, but it's the online faceless, nameless individuals that will just sit on their computer from their couch and type the most vile and hurtful comments. They do impact, words have an impact, but also to those working in the media. You know, sometimes the stories that you run and the way that they're written, they fuel that online hatred. So there is a link. And I think we have to have a very mature conversation about that because, you know, we see it happening in other countries as well, this this drive towards, I suppose, online hatred and spreading of hate and attacking individuals.
But you know, Lisa, what's staggering, I think a lot of people were very upset about Caroline Flack taking her own life. Mm. And yet this morning, when I tweet that four women were coming on, these warriors on these keyboards keep sending out this nonsense. It's like they're not affected
but
by
compassion.
But it's
not just us. I mean, you see young children, girls and boys in school who are having this done to them, which is probably in some ways more worrying. I mean, we're probably tough-ish because we're out there, you know, as a public representative, we put our names on ballot papers. But young people are being subject to that as well. And, you know, I mean, I would worry about that. I think that really
And just to be
addressed.
Fair, there's a lot of nice messages, so I'm going to read some of them. Too many to read all. Very sorry to see all four of your guests losing their seats. Their loss is something that will be felt in their constituencies and in the media nationwide. I look forward to seeing some of them at least returning to politics in the future. There'll be one. Their legacy will prevail. That's from Tom in Dingle. Very difficult for women to get to the top of the ladder, says another in local organisations. That's the root of the problem. Another says, four wonderful women on Miriam this morning. Genuine, thoughtful and hardworking. Their presence will be missed in Irish life. Another says, I'm not a Fianna Fáil supporter. I'm so sorry to see Lisa lose her seat. I have no doubt she will be back. A Mayo voter there for you, Lisa. And one more. Ironic, Miriam, that the women are talking about online and media criticism and abuse on the day after Caroline Flack has died. That's from Sam in Dublin. Well, we all said that. Listen, my pleasure to have you all.
Thank you,
Regina,
very much,
Jan, Catherine, Lisa. Lisa, best of luck
Thank
with
you.
Your baby. Just to say
Thank
the answer
you,
to our question was Storm Dennis, and the winner is Catherine Lyons from Kilrodry and Bray. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Denise Davies was our BCO. Shanna Gorham produced. We've been rejoined by the Lost Brothers. Remind people again of your dates, quick.
So, yeah, we start in Oma, then we go to Belfast, Dublin, Vicar Street, Galway, Castlebar, Letterkenny, Waterford, Cork and Limerick, and it's March and April.
Yeah. Well, Mark and Oisin, everyone said earlier, sublime. Best of luck to you both. You're beautiful guys. What are you singing us out on?
We're going to sing a song from the new album called 800 Miles.
Great. We'll dedicate it to these female politicians who probably walked 800 miles.
We have an audience here.
Yeah, go.
Loving it.
Thanks so much.
See you in Dolans.
Right.
I'll be gone in the grey winter sun, forever tied to oblivion. I don't have to hate anyone, 800 miles to run, 800 miles to run. Hidden lands and broken trust, I will go where I think I must. Empty towns, they scatter like dust, 800 miles of rust, 800 miles of rust. I will have but one thing to do. The darkened hill will be long out of view. All is gone I thought would last, 800 miles to pass, 800 miles. Gold.
800 miles of gold.